It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. For many, Thanksgiving's origin story conjures images of a landmark meal shared by pilgrims and Native Americans. But our guest says that's not quite what happened. He tells us how the meal took on a narrative more romantic than real and explains how the myth affects Native people today. When you think about Thanksgiving's origin story, what were you taught in school, and what do you know about it now? Has your perception of what happened changed over the years? How did that happen? Do you celebrate Thanksgiving differently as a result? Tell us about that. Do you celebrate at all? Are you a Native American? What does the Thanksgiving holiday represent to you? Do you wish people would amend their understanding of this origin story? What do you want people to know about how this affects perceptions of Native Americans? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gary Johnson is a professor emeritus from UW-Superior, where he directed the First Nations Center and coordinated the First Nations program. He is an enrolled member of the Lakotere Band of Ojibwe. Gary, thanks for coming into our studios this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So when we think about Thanksgiving's origin story, there are some who think of pilgrims and members of the Wampanoag tribe sitting around a table happily sharing a giant meal to celebrate the pilgrims' first harvest after Native Americans taught them how to farm. Perhaps there's a giant turkey being carved up. Okay, what do we know about what it was really like?
Actually, we don't know a lot. There's only one account of that so-called First Thanksgiving, and it doesn't give a lot of details about it. But what most people think of is the pilgrims giving thanks for having survived through the winter, and most people think that they invited the Indians in because they helped them survive and things like that, but that's not quite what was happening there.
So who were the pilgrims giving thanks to?
Well, they gave thanks to God for letting them survive. They didn't give much credit to the Native people that were helping them. The Native people provided them with the right crops to grow and then how to grow. The climate was very different from where they came from in England, and so they weren't very prepared for what they encountered here. And the tribes did help them because that's our nature, is to help people that are in trouble and stuff like that, so we did help them. But this idea of them being buddy-buddy and stuff like that, that wasn't really true.
Well, the meal has kind of come to symbolize this sort of peaceful coexistence between the pilgrims and the Native people. That's not true. So what was the real situation?
Well, at best, they were like maybe tolerant allies. one of the problems is that, you know, they escaped religious persecution in England and came over and decided to establish the same policy over here. They had a lot of ethnocentricity about how their way of life was right, because the Native people they encountered were not like anything they'd ever heard about or seen about. And they were coming out of that Middle Ages type of thing, you know, the Crusades and stuff like that, and they believed it was their mission to Christianize the world. And so the Native people obviously weren't Christian, and so one of the first things they did is try to impose their will upon the Native people.
And how was that received?
Well, how would you like somebody coming in and telling you how to live, how to pray? And
right. Not good, in other words.
Right.
Yeah. And yet they were tolerated. What kind of food did they eat, and was turkey involved?
Could have been, but if anybody ever hunted turkey, you know that they're not very easy to get. And so most likely it was probably ducks, maybe geese, something along those lines. But more likely it was fish, eel, lobster, things like that. It was New England, so those were very readily available and stuff like that. And the idea that they invited the Indians wasn't really true either. They were celebrating this harvest, and they were shooting, probably having competitions and stuff with their guns and stuff like that. And so Indian people heard all this shooting, and they thought, well, we better go check this out. So then they came along, and so then once they were there, they're like, well, we better eat. And so then the Native people brought things like venison and some of the other things that we come to associate with it, corn and stuff like that. But it wasn't very likely that turkey was even on that first Thanksgiving table.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about, for example, Squanto, we think of someone who helped the pilgrims by acting as a translator between them and the Wampanoag and showing them how to farm the land. Is that accurate, or are we missing a big chunk of the picture here?
Well, you have to remember that Squanto was a slave. He'd been taken back to England and had lived over there for years. And so he learned English as a means of getting away, of escaping. And then when he came back, he did help them. He did show them proper planting techniques in the crops, like the Three Sisters, corn, squash, and beans that grow well in that area. But the idea that he was all for this was, you know, was not really accurate.
There was no parade down the main drag in New York City, and no giant balloons. Was it even called Thanksgiving?
No.
I mean, was it called anything? I mean,
it was just a harvest feast type of thing.
The meal takes on a significance for us today, but was this meal as significant to the pilgrims and Native Americans of the time as history books suggest?
No. It was just a meal between, like I said, coexisting allies and stuff like that. And the main thing is that they were not equals. They didn't look at each other as equals, especially the pilgrims and the Puritans that followed after them. They looked down upon the Native people and thought it was their mission to, like I said, to Christianize them.
Well, they thought the Native people were savages.
Exactly, because they didn't worship the same God. They didn't, in their minds, they didn't go to a church. They didn't practice religion and things like that.
Gary Johnson is a professor emeritus from UW-Superior, where he directed the First Nations Center and coordinated the First Nations program. When you think about Thanksgiving's origin story, what were you taught in school, and what do you know about it now? Do you wish people would amend their understanding of this story? What do you want people to know about how this affects perceptions of Native Americans today? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. How did the story of this meal in 1621 evolve into the narrative most Americans think of today?
Well, there was a letter that was written, and I'm sorry, but I can't remember who wrote it, but to kind of laid out what was going on there. And then after that, the relationship between natives and non-natives deteriorated pretty rapidly. And it was when the Native people resisted, many times the answer was just to get rid of them, to kill them. And so there was this warlike atmosphere between the two that, and pretty soon they realized they just weren't going to get along. One of the things that the Puritans did is they brought in the chief of the Wampanoags that was trying to help them to survive and stuff like that. And as a sign of getting rid of this resistance, they cut his head off, stuck it on a pole that sat outside their fort for like 20 years as a symbol of resistance.
Mm.
So you can imagine that that relationship was just not going to work out.
Okay. We're going to continue our conversation with Gary Johnson in just a moment. What do you think about Thanksgiving? What have you been taught about it? What do you know? What do you understand? What would you like to know? 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, this is Thanksgiving week, and we celebrate this holiday every year, but do many of us actually know how it got started and what it's all about, and how do we separate the myth and the romance from what really happened and how it affects people today? Are you a Native American? Do you what does the holiday mean to you? How does it represent itself? Do you wish people would amend their understanding of this origin story that we've been talking about? What do you want people to know about how this affects perceptions of Native Americans? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gary Johnson is with us. Gary's a professor emeritus from UW-Superior. He directed the First Nations Center and coordinated the First Nations program at UW-Superior. And Truth in Advertising, he and I went to high school together as well. I'll at least admit that, Gary. You might not want to. Just kind of jump forward. We had this origin story of this, the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag and everybody getting along, and then we moved from that to the Puritans cutting the head off the Wampanoag chief and displaying it as a trophy. How does the way the narrative developed about Thanksgiving affect Native Americans today?
Well, that narrative only says part of it. And so many times dealing with Native people, we're dealing with people that grew up on the myth of what Native people were. And so part of what our program has done for so long is try to set the record straight, because you can't really deal with each other until you come to a place of understanding and truth between each other. And too many times, if we don't look like that myth, we don't get recognized. They don't see us. And then when we stand up for things that are important to us, people don't want to hear it. They want the myth. They don't want the reality of what's out there. And so as Native people, we are still very misunderstood as to how we live, what we believe, how we govern, and things like that. And so if we can get rid of some of those myths, we're not trying to ruin Thanksgiving. Many Native people practice Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is part of our culture. It's what we do, but we don't do it just that one day. We have Thanksgivings throughout the whole year. I mean, whenever, you know, the harvest is only part of it. You know, we give thanks for everything, because we refer to the earth as our mother. Because everything we have in this life comes from the earth, and we have to give thanks. So we have to recognize that gift that she's given us so that we can survive. The food, the clothes, everything that we have in this world comes from the earth. And so we give thanks for that. You know, whenever we go out to harvest something, we always put down some asema, tobacco, and give thanks, because we understand that that is a sacrifice, that is a gift that we're giving. And so then we do a Thanksgiving afterwards. You know, when our children get their first deer, we have a feast for that, to give thanks, to show that we recognize this. When we gather wild rice, when we gather maple syrup, whenever we gather medicine, forest products, whatever it might be, we always give a gift of tobacco and say thanks and have a first feast for that. So we do it the year round. Mm-hmm. It's a daily thing. We're supposed to start off each morning and give an offering of tobacco and thank the Creator for letting us get up one more day. As I get older, I understand that more and more.
Yeah, well, my dad always said, every day on the green side of the sod is a good day, and you should appreciate it.
Exactly. That's what the Thanksgiving is about. It's not just that one day, mm-hmm. and to recognize that.
One of the other big issues over the last number of decades, actually, today, many American communities, roads, military aircraft have Native American names. What's that say to you about how Americans regard Native people?
Well, it's part of that stereotype. You know, all they see us for is the savage part, the warlike qualities and stuff like that. There are many tribes that didn't even go on the war path, for crying out loud. And so it perpetuates that image of that historical warrior type of thing. You know, when I talk to groups, a lot of times I'll ask them, what's the first thing that pops into your head, first image that pops into your head when I talk about American Indians or Native Americans? And generally it's that stereotypical image. You know, so I'll ask them, I said, did you ever think of a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, a woman? You know, so we're constantly having to fight that stereotype. And so one of the things we'd like to get across is that we're part of this contemporary world. You know, after the Europeans got here, when they first got here, there was probably 100, 120 million native people. And after the Europeans came here, we lost about 90% of our population. A lot of that due to the illnesses that they brought with them, but also to the policies of just, you know, it was a policy in this country at one time to exterminate all the native people. We've rebounded now and there are about 50 million native people, but still, you know, we have to constantly fight that stereotypical image. And you go to most elementary schools right now, you can walk in there and they've probably got half them kids dressed up as pilgrims, half them dressed up with little paper feather headbands on. So we kind of perpetuate this myth, this stereotype, and that's what we need to get rid of. We cannot truly understand each other without getting rid of that.
Yeah, how do we fix that? Are there any efforts being made to remedy what our textbooks so consistently get wrong?
Well, there's me.
Yeah, well, we're here today, so I guess that's a start. But
well, our program has been fighting that for about almost 30 years, trying to set that record to give the information. And it always amazes me that, you know, after a while you think, well, they're going to stop learning this stuff. No. You know, a lot of the students were angry, like, how come I was never taught these things? So one of the things we can do is get the schools to quit perpetuating some of those things. Columbus Day, Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How can we, as individuals, without going back to school, how can we overcome the stereotypes we've perpetuated about Native Americans?
Well, get to know some Native people. One of the problems is that for most people, Native people aren't somebody you sit down at the table with and have a meal with and talk about life and things like that. So you have to try to take the opportunities when they arise. You know, the program I had here, we offered stuff at least once a month for people to come and experience what real Native culture was about, to interact, to bump elbows with Native people. You can go to a powwow. There's things happening all the time. There's concerts. There's lectures. There's things to do, but you're going to have to probably take the incentive to go out there, and that's tough. That's really tough for some people because it gets you out of your comfort zone. I was standing around at one of our powwows one time with one of the faculty here. I won't tell who it was. But she was like, you know, she looked all nervous. And I said, what's wrong? She goes, I don't know if I'm supposed to be here. I'm not Indian. And I'm like, well, this is not just for Indian people. It's for everybody. Just come and enjoy, experience that. Powwow is one of the best ways to see Native people interacting.
Okay. Your experience, obviously, growing up where you did in Hayward, as I did, I guess I could say that it's possible to live in a community like that and know absolutely nothing. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. The places like Hayward and Spooner, which are on the edge of Indian country, seem to have the tallest walls of any place. In the most misinformation about each other. This is where a lot of the fear comes from, and it's just from misinformation. And when you just use the media for your information, I mean, all they tend to cover is the negative things. You don't see a lot of positive things going on in Indian country being talked about and stuff like that. And so those are some of the toughest places because they're right there. And the prejudices and the stereotypes build up, and there's like a wall around the reservation that people think that they can't come into, and the Native people are dreadful to go across it, too. So you have to break down those walls.
There's a lot of fear.
Yes. It's human nature to fear what you don't know. And so you have to take that step to say, well, I'm not going to live in fear. I'm going to find out about these things and to find out that the stereotypes aren't real. I used to teach a class every summer, and we did it from a Native perspective where I took them to Indian country. We went to the reservation. We went to Madeline Island, places like that, so they could actually meet Indian people, see them in their natural living conditions and stuff like that. And I'll never forget one day we're driving across the reservation down at LCO, and we went up by the Chippewa Flowage, and one of the guys looks at me and he says, this is the reservation? I said, well, yeah, this is part of it. He says, geez, it ain't that bad, huh? But that's what I'm talking about. You have to get out of that comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And then you find out that, geez, this isn't that bad, huh?
There you go. Okay, well, you know what? I think that's a good place to leave it. I hope that we've managed to clear up some things and maybe get some people to do a little thinking that would be beneficial to them. And, well, McGwich.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Gary Johnson for coming into our Superior studios this morning. He's a professor emeritus from UW-Superior, where he directed the First Nations Center and coordinated the First Nations program. He's also an enrolled member of the Lac-Couturier Band of Ojibwe. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In the 2010 census, 4.2 million Americans identified as belonging to more than one race, and that number is projected to rise. Our guest explains how high-profile biracial individuals like President Barack Obama and Duchess of Sussex Meghan Markle are symbolic of societal changes. We also discuss how race and identity intersect, how traditional views of race reinforce structural racism, and how biracial and multi-ethnic identities may help evolve culture. Are you biracial or multi-ethnic? How has that impacted your experience of life? Share your story with us. Are you in a biracial or multi-ethnic family? What conversations do you have around identity? How do you think society can embrace our changing demographic? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kimberly Barrett is the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. She also writes columns for the Appleton Post Crescent. Kimberly, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
You say that race is a social construction. It might seem obvious to some. Explain that to us.
Well, many times we think about race as being something biological, you know, the color of your skin or the shape of features, facial features. But in fact, race, the way that we understand it today, really came into being in the 1600s, 1700s, when a number of different groups came together in North America. And around that, we had this issue of slavery and also the separation of people from their lands, indigenous peoples from their lands. And in order to justify that, for the first time in human history, we began to think about whether or not these groups of people who look different might be more or less human. And so we began to institutionalize this issue of white supremacy to justify at a time in the world when we were really looking at this idea of universal human rights and all men, and at that time it was men being created equal. How could we justify disenfranchising, indigenous people, people from Africa who were slaves? And so we began to speculate about whether or not there were humans who were less human than others. And so in order to justify the current economic and social order, we began to talk about race as if it was something that was, this very definite, impermeable category.
Well, and not to spend too much time on this aspect, but I mean, there was quite a bit of effort placed in trying to find some sort of science that would back up those racial theories, wasn't there?
There was eugenics and a number of frenetics and a number of things that people used to try and look at these very surface, superficial differences and try to connect them to inequities that we were beginning to see in terms of people's achievements and well-being. And so, you know, there was a huge amount of sort of pseudoscience that evolved around this, and really, you know, unfortunately served as the basis for some of the Nazi philosophies and experiments.
So race is a social construct. Let's shift then to identity. How do you define identity?
Well, identity is really who you say you are and how the world sees you. It's really an interaction between, you know, how we see ourselves, some things that maybe sort of we're predisposed to, and then how the world sees us. And many times we've thought about identity throughout history as being something that, again, is something that's permanent. But what we're beginning to learn is that identity shifts throughout our lifetimes. What is important to how we see ourselves and how we see the world shifts. And that's the same in terms of our ethnicity and this thing we call race. And one of the important things that people who are biracial or multi-ethnic sort of illustrate for us is, you know, quite clearly how these things change.
And how does, race becomes an essential component then of the identity that we choose for ourselves? Is that how that works?
Well, I think society really has made this a part of who we are. While I say that race is illusion, I would even go as far to say it's a myth that we sort of permeate every day, that we perpetrate every day with terrible consequences. I would say that culture has created this identity that has a lot of consequences for us. And instead of looking at the structural barriers and conditions that create certain outcomes, you know, like difficulty getting financing for a house and thus less, you know, wealth. What we've done is we've ascribed that to these categories called race. And so while I'm saying race is an illusion, racism is very real.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about white racial identity. How does that develop?
Well, I think for all of us, when we talk about racial identity, there's a point at which this is learned. And so there's a point at which you're not aware of this thing called race until you encounter a situation where you see that you are treated differently because of this skin color, right? And so for white people, often what happens is you have some encounter with an oppressive oppressed group or marginalized group, and you begin to realize your power. And so when you talk about white racial identity development, ideally what happens is you go from sort of being unaware of this thing called whiteness to developing a consciousness of whiteness, and then understanding sort of an anti-racist way of being related to this understanding, so that you become an ally and a partner in making social change that can lift everyone's boat and decrease racism in society. So it's really a process of enlightenment in its best form. Like all development, we don't all make it to sort of the most sophisticated, highest levels, but you know, we can either choose to, once we become aware of these issues, we can choose to become allies, learn more, educate ourselves, and develop an anti-racist identity.
Compare that then to how black racial identity develops.
Well, again, you start out with sort of this not being aware of this thing called race, because it is something that is learned. And what we do, and usually it happens earlier in life, because if you're privileged, part of your privilege is you don't have to think about this thing called race. But if you're a person of color, particularly an African American in the United States, you, again, have this encounter with you know, these inequities related to race, and you realize that, oh, I'm different. You know, I am not this, you know, privileged other, this person that you might call white, and I can't be that. And so Many people at that point really began to immerse themselves in understanding African-American culture, Black culture, and really sort of immersing themselves in that to understand it and be able to, at some point, hopefully again, just as in white development, develop a consciousness that would allow them to ally with others to work towards social justice. And so, but, you know, it can result in people, you know, really sort of being in this fight mode for a lot of their lives, just understanding how do I deal with this constant, you know, stress, pressure, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But hopefully in both cases, we get to a point where we can work through these issues, feel good about who we are, no matter what our identities might be, no matter what our ethnic backgrounds might be. And then from a point of strength and self-esteem, work together for social justice.
And so we're all on a continuum of some sort, in a way, I guess, would be one way to look at it.
Yeah, I think coming from a point of just totally not being aware of issues of identity to being able to understand who we are, feel good about that, both the good and the bad of the structural inequities that groups we belong to have been part of, and then learn how we can make a difference. What the problem is when we get defensive and become really sort of caught up in this, what I would call, to use a slang term, sort of tribalism, where we see it, we don't see our human, our, you know, common humanity.
Yeah, and so much of that is fear-based. What is it that we're afraid of?
Well, I think we're afraid of a couple of things. One is that somehow we're not being that good girl or good boy or good person that, you know, we think we should be. And so when we come to understand the history of injustice related to various groups in our society, we want to say that we're not part of that, that this is not me. But to realize that whether it's you or not, once you become aware of it, you can make a difference. I think that's what people should focus on. It's fear of losing status. We talk about power differentials. It's fear of being seen as immoral, doing the wrong thing. And I think it's fear of change. You know, culture evolves and changes, and the unknown causes a lot of fear.
And change can be messy at times. We're going to continue our conversation with Kimberly Barrett, Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. She also writes columns for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Are you biracial or multi-ethnic? How's that impacted your experience? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In the 2010 census, 4.2 million Americans identified as belonging to more than one race, and that number is going to go up. We're discussing how race and identity intersect, how traditional views of race reinforce structural racism, and how biracial and multi-ethnic identities may help evolve culture. What do you think about all of this? Are you biracial or multi-ethnic? How's that impacted your experience? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Kimberly Barrett is the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. She also writes columns for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Kimberly, our culture has evolved into this rigid structure based on skin color, black, white, brown, whatever, but it's based on that. Talk to us about how identity development can be a struggle then, particularly for biracial or multi-ethnic people.
You know, I think historically we have assumed that it was a struggle. I think what I found is the mother of a biracial, multi-ethnic person, and also in looking at the research, is that it can actually be beneficial in terms of self-esteem and understanding the complexity of identity early on. I know that being aware of the racism in society, my husband and I took quite a intentional effort to make sure that early on our son understood all aspects of his identity. My husband, although he identifies as white, is a member of a Native American tribe, a nation on the West Coast, and we have always shared information with him about that. We did Kwanzaa, so he understood, some of the traditions of the African diaspora, and of course, made him aware of other aspects of his ethnic identity early on. And so what takes some of us, many years, even into adulthood, to understand in terms of the multidimensional nature of identity, I think he and some other biracial individuals understand that much sooner. On the other hand, because society is not used to looking at that complexity, it can be difficult to figure out sometimes where do you belong. Of course, we hope that people understand that they belong in all of those groups and, again, can sort of understand the benefits of this broad, beloved community, that Martin Luther King Jr. used to talk about, that is inclusive and where we sort of understand our sort of shared humanity.
Let's talk a little bit about demographics. We know that the number of biracial or multi-ethnic Americans are going up. That number, that's a fact. The number is increasing. What do we expect our population to look like in a few generations?
Well, I think that in a few generations, it'll be clear that, the fact is that we are one species. There is only one group of Homo sapiens on the earth today. And so I think that will become clear as we see the diversity within family groups, diversities within communities. Unfortunately, since the 80s in the United States, we've begun to sort of resegregate around race and socioeconomic status. But I think that with this sort of evolution of families that are multicultural, it'll become very clear and visible, this illusion of race. And I think it will really help us see the structural inequities that have resulted in the differences that we attribute to race.
President Barack Obama famously said, "I am the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible." Kimberly, how does President Obama's experience reflect that of biracial Americans?
Well, I think that he is kind of the epitome of somebody who is biracial and identifies as African-American. And so I think what he said it better than I certainly could. In the U.S., we are probably the most diverse nation in terms of ethnic groups and just backgrounds, different backgrounds that people have who have come together to live here. And so I think he's a wonderful example of, the positive impact that owning this identity can have. I think there are other people who are biracial who will identify in other ways. Meghan Markle, she is someone who identifies as biracial. She doesn't necessarily identify as African-American, but biracial. And so there are a number of people, depending on their experiences, where they come from, who identify differently with the same, parental background in terms of what we might call one black and one white parent may identify differently. And again, I think this is just an example of the diversity that we have in the United States, and the possibilities for how people choose to identify that really sort of illustrates this illusion of race.
We had a caller, Paula, in Madison, who couldn't stay with us, but her story is that she is Mexican, but has light skin, and people don't believe her when she tells them that she's Mexican. She feels a lot of struggle because she doesn't feel like she's white, but she doesn't feel like she's Mexican either. Is Paula's story one that's common among people who are multi-ethnic or biracial?
It is, particularly people who you might consider are white assumed, and that some people, you know, years ago might call white passing. Because of the, you know, hardships, oppression, and, you know, the flip side of that, the privileges that people with lighter skin have, there's often some feelings of, you know, do I fit in? Do I belong? But I think looking at, yes, this is who I am. This is what I look like. Yes, I may have some privileges associated with that, given the structures that exist in a society currently. But I also have this heritage. I think owning it all is the key. And for all of us, understanding that, in fact, most people in the United States are multi-ethnic. And if we could understand that and maybe get beyond these, you know, dichotomies of black and white, that would help people, like our caller, understand that they fit wherever they choose to fit.
You know, and there's the crux of it. I mean, you write that thinking of society in terms of black and white reinforces structures of white supremacy, black suppression that build much of the world. Black and white are the colors of racism. How can we evolve past that mindset?
Well, I think first we have to understand what you began the interview with, this idea that race is a social construction. It is something that we created to support a certain economic and social order. And as that changes, which it is obviously changing today, you know, we need to find a new way of thinking about and describing who we are. For example, you know, I grew up in the South and just took for granted that I was black. And today I'm very careful to describe myself as African-American because that's my ethnic heritage. That's my ethnic background. And it really does influence who I see myself as being and the way I experience the world and how other people see me. And so I'm very, very clear about choosing to call myself African-American as my ethnicity.
And I guess it's going to be time, it's going to be education, and some patience, I suppose, is involved. But we've had a while to fix this, and we've got a ways to go. Thank you, Kimberly Barrett, for sharing this moment with us this morning.
Thank you.
Kimberly Barrett is the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Lawrence University. She also writes columns for the Appleton Post-Crescent. I mentioned patience a moment ago. We're going to talk about patience next hour as the morning show continues. We hope you'll stay with us. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.